not a con.
Rock. All right, good afternoon. Wow, we've actually got a lot of people here. This is like amazing. I think this is more than Froggy had for the keynote. Sorry, Paul. To begin with, just out of curiosity, before we start, are there any feds in the room? FBI? Come on.
They're not going to own up to it. They have to.
Any AOL users? You can leave. Who's the other one? Leave now. All right, last question. Who here is doing the scavenger hunt? No one is doing the Nauticon scavenger hunt? You are. Well, you're already taken. Anybody else doing the scavenger hunt? Nobody? This is staff excluded. Okay.
Staff excluded.
The reason why I ask is because one of the items there, I found out. Four points to get your picture taken with a speaker. So what I figured to do, and I would offer to y'all, would be if you were participating, we'd come up here, we'll do one group picture, and we'll call it like 100 points. You know, and just, you know, because I was surprised when I showed up yesterday, and I'm sitting there talking to Tiger, and all of a sudden these flashes are going off the corner of my eye. And I'm like, I haven't been drinking yet. And I see certain people like mugging behind me. It's like, what the bloody hell is going on here? And she's just like, I'm like, ah, shit. So the offer stands. I'll make the offer again at the end for those who are just showing up now. This talk is going to be pretty informal, go along with the conference anyway. And the title is a little misleading. I wanted to put something to do with community because, well, this is a community-oriented conference. And even though I'm a security geek, you know, I kind of wanted to apply the spirit of the theme of the conference to my talk. So there's the word community in there. Say no more. What I'm going to talk about is really one of the major issues in the security field. Who here is a security geek by trade or by hardcore interest anyway? Okay, just so I can get a feel for the audience. All right. We all look at IT security vulnerabilities and you get all the mailing lists, bug track, vulndev, full disclosure, first, NSPSec, all these lists are out there. They're the ISACs and the US CERT. You have the NIPSI. And some other folks. And they were all designed to share information and help resolve security vulnerabilities. That's what they were chartered to do. Unfortunately, as we've seen, there's still no consensus on what constitutes information sharing. You've got people who say, on one hand, you know, information should be free, the John Perry Barlows of the world. And we heard that last night from Richard's talk. Pass it all out to the world, let everybody have equal opportunity to use this information. On the other hand, you've got the people who say information could be used for evil. And the fact that it could be used, could, bold, italic, underlined, blink tag, could, means that we have to restrict its distribution because otherwise it could, bold, blink, italic, underlined, be used for evil. And there are two very opposite ends of the extreme, and there's still no consensus on it. And despite all the hype and hoopla we've got now since 9/11 and Homeland Security, whether you're talking about cybersecurity, chemical plant security, aviation security, or lack thereof, the debate still rages on. So that's what the talk is about. And I'm not approaching it from purely technology track. Richard hinted at it last night in his talk where he said about, you know, creativity is not just technology-based. It can start there or it can end there, but you can't just operate in a vacuum. And you can't create new ideas within the construct of your current box. You have to think outside the box, or in some cases, bring your own box with you. So in that regard, I'm going to start off and talk about the greater concept of the vulnerability disclosure debate, which falls under risk communications. And I'm going to go through a few slides and end up with some recommendations on where we really need to focus if we're ever going to get this issue resolved and not continue this treading water approach that we're seeing now in both in the cyberspace, physical space, whatever security space you're talking about. Risk communications is actually a professional discipline. It's been around for, you know, 30 or 40 years as a discipline. It's basically, how do we communicate risks to people, the public? users, the community. There are any number of examples. You can Google for several. The one I use, I like using, is from the Army Center for Health Promotion. And basically says it's a process of building and maintaining relationships based on trust. And trust, as many of you know, is a major buzzword in the IT space, right? You know, we have trusted systems, trusted computing platform architecture. Yeah, right. Microsoft has trusted. Well, let's not go there. VeriSign provides trust with certificates, maybe. Trust is a nice new marketing buzzword. But unfortunately, a lot of times, trust always comes back to technology. And we look to technology, again, as the savior for our current problems in the real world. Risk communications, yes, communications does rely on technology, voice, video, data, internet. But it's not just a geek thing that we in this room can understand and appreciate and work on. We all have parents. Many of them probably have computers who may use AOL. How many folks have had to teach their parents how to use email? Myself included. Was that a fun process? No. How many folks have had to fix their parents' computers when they've had a problem, spyware, malicious code, whatever? Okay, was that a fun process?
Not over yet.
Not over yet. Talking with your parents as you were doing this troubleshooting, whether you realized it or not, was a form of risk communication. You are trying to espouse your wisdom, your knowledge to them, say, look, you know, mom, you know, don't use Internet Explorer. I gave you this thing called Firefox. It's really cool, but it's also really good. Here's why. You're communicating risks. This didn't require technology to do so. Technology was sort of the medium that occurred, but you were talking directly to them. It is not reliant on technology buzzwords. And I know from being in D.C., the political capital of the world, and a lot of the IT capital there, technology is everywhere. Technology is our savior. You know, in Deus Machina. That's a frightening prospect when we're trying to talk about issues that affect our safety, our security. This slide actually builds on some stuff I spoke about in past conferences. And it's a very, 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 very high-level view of three schools of thought regarding the disclosure of security vulnerabilities. A lot of this is based on IT security, but they're equally applicable for security in the real world, as well as public safety issues, medical issues, epidemics, spread of viruses, nuclear power plant meltdowns, chemical spills. These are all related. The three schools are pretty self-explanatory, as I said earlier. On one hand, you've got people who say, let's just give the world everything. Information wants to be out there. Scott Culp at Microsoft coined that wonderful term, information anarchy, fearing that all this information will cause any number of bad guys to do even worse things. On the opposite side of the coin are the zero disclosure folks. Most of these are the government and vendors, most recently Sybase. These folks basically fall in the mindset of, trust us, we know what's best, we will fix it for you, just live your life and do what you want to do. But trust us. You know, we're the government, we're here to help. We're Sybase, we're here to help. In the middle is a growing medium, what's become known as responsible disclosure, which simply, to drum it down, says, I'm Jim Lichko, I found a vulnerability in a product. I will call the vendor, I'll give the vendor a week, 2 weeks, a month, whatever, a reasonable amount of time, a realistic amount of time, to fix the problem, acknowledge it, fix it, offer some sort of countermeasure, some solution, or fix or patch. And if they don't, or if it doesn't happen in that time frame, or they ignore me, at the end of that 30 days, whatever, I will release this announcement to the world saying, there's a problem in FARC 3.44 that if you do X, Y, and Z, I don't know, Jenna Jameson will pop up on the banner. Okay.
Damn.
Okay, I'm sorry, I meant Bill Gates. Sorry, Drew. And the vendors look at that as blackmail. Oh my God, how dare you? You know, you don't know our product. We know our product. It's our product. We coded it. So these people in the middle try to find a way that leverages the vendor's interests, business interests, software interests, and the realistic needs to get this stuff fixed with the community's interest, the need to know, the desire to know. What this leads to are a series of countervailing benefits across the board. If you go down the full disclosure route and say, share it with the world, everybody knows everything. That is a great thing. I love that, me personally. The flip side is, if I know it, so do the bad guys. extend that logic out, who are the bad guys? A competitor? A black hat hacker? A foreign cyber warrior? We don't know. But the information's out there, and it's for the picking. Anybody can use it. On the zero disclosure side, and this is a big one that people don't often talk about, by restricting the information and classifying it or keeping it to a close cartel, how do you provide accountability when problems occur or potential problems occur and they're covered up? This last bullet is very, I see this all the time in talking with the Homeland Security officials about changes that have happened since 9/11 with regards to chemical plants, airport security, port security, epidemics and medical issues. And as you may see by reading the newspapers even, this is a huge problem because a report comes out from the government, the General Accounting Office. They say there's a big problem with our airplane, aviation security, but they can't publish the results. There's a problem, but we can't tell you about it. Okay, well, if the public, who technically should be holding the political folks accountable for their public safety and security, can't hold their people accountable, is the public being well served? What do you think? I don't think so. However, if the report comes out and says, well, United Airlines Flight 447 from Dallas to Seattle had no cockpit door, it was a Boeing whatever, that's a little much. That's a specific vulnerability. The plane is now currently in Chicago. That, you don't need to go that far. But you need to have a level of accountability to hold not just the politicians accountable, but the vendors. NGSS is a great example, or EI, pick your vulnerability researchers du jour. I view these folks as almost like a third-party auditor, an inspector general. They're holding the vendors accountable for their products and keeping us safer through their efforts. I'm not a coder. I make no bones about being a coder. But knowing that these guys are out there makes me feel a little bit better knowing that I can trust my software or trust certain software. And there's a huge fight about that, and we'll talk about that. But in the middle category, and this has received much attention as a potential solution, responsible disclosure. Sure, we can come together and share information in a forum or a conference or a restricted mailing list. But the question remains, who identifies who the good guys are? I'll give you a great example. There are IT security, there's BugTrack, and then there's a government version of BugTrack called Information Sharing Analysis Centers, the ISACs. Financial services have one. All the banks get together and share information. But where do you draw the line between a big bank like MasterCard or Chase and, I'm gonna pick on Melinda. Melinda's small little bank in Cleveland. If they can't pay the $50,000 membership fee to join and support this ISAC, they're a financial institution, but they're cut out of the loop. Picture that now in the energy sector, the utilities, and transportation sector, IT sector. Where do you draw that line? If you're president of Melinda Bank, yeah, you want to know what's going on. You want to be playing on the same level playing field as the big guys. But if you can't ante up the money to get that information, you're SOL. This is a growing source of contention in the entire homeland security debate regarding information sharing. And there is no clear-cut answer yet. Theme hit it last night because he was talking about the challenges of these bureaucratic institutions and old ways of thinking and thinking inside the box. So part of this talk is going to look at ways to get outside of that box and hopefully, maybe not right now, but in the foreseeable future, come to some level of agreement on this. And it's not as difficult as some may think so. But right now, we've got a lot of challenges in sharing information. How much is too much? Who's the good guy? Who are the bad guys? Some of the challenges. Best example was on September 11th. Rudy Giuliani, he was a good guy, was good, bad, depending on what you think of him. He said something on 9/11 repeatedly that really, really made me respect him, at least as a crisis manager. You know what he said when he was doing his briefings from New York on that morning and that afternoon? When he was holding the press briefings, he looked at the camera or he responded to reporters and said, "I don't know." Do you know the impact of such and such and such? I don't know yet. We can't get in there to look at it and assess it until the fires are out or the rubble is removed. How many politicians that you know of have ever said, "I don't know," to a reporter? Yeah?
Zero.
Oh, zero. Okay. I agree. I don't know if you're raising a fist at me or what. You know, I'm like, all right, I'll shut up now, you know.
They right. just use different words. They didn't say, "I don't know."
Right. But "I don't know" is clear, direct, and whether you're a 10-year-old or a 100-year-old, you know what it means. A politician will say, "I don't know," and use 100 words, and you'll figure he is the most brilliant person in the world, the most well-informed on the issue. It's called spin, or as the shirts out there say, newspeak. Yeah. I am so not going down that path. I'll hold court in the bar this evening if you want to discuss this. I'll be in a better frame of mind to discuss. But being honest, Microsoft is the master of spinning honesty. What are vulnerabilities called in Redmond?
Feature.
No, that's what we call them. They are called issues. Microsoft has discovered an issue in Internet Explorer version 6.01 that could affect blah, 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 blah. Well, an issue doesn't sound as bad as a major problem. Ergo, people will be, "Oh, that's interesting. What's on TV?" Right? They spin it. They're not being open and honest directly with the end users, with the people, with the community. What you see here is just the rest of this list is a laundry list of some of the challenges that we're facing right now in the security community with regards to information sharing. I'm not going to go through them all. Who or what is the adversary? That ties to what I just said about the big banks, small banks. You know, you want to include all the relevant parties, but exclude the bad guys. Well, if you're a small bank and you can't play with the big guys, does that mean you're a friendly adversary? Because you're not, you know, sitting at the big kids' table? We don't know. We're seeing a hard look at what's called friendly strangers. A lot of people here are friendly strangers. I see several people here once, maybe twice a year, if that. See them on LiveJournal, see them on email or IRC, but friendly strangers. I trust some of them. Hopefully they trust me. But I don't know them as well as I would know my girlfriend or close friends. But yet I trust them more than I trust somebody outside. Okay, and there are different degrees of trust, and we'll talk about those in a minute. Talk about accountability. And again, these are issues that I will be touching on. But how do we hold accountability for somebody who provides bad information or dubious or misleading information into an information exchange system? Bad intelligence. We saw this last week with the CIA report that came out that says, "Oh, we really screwed up on the intelligence for Iraq. Oops." It was 401 pages that said, "Oops." How can we hold people accountable for that sort of material? I don't think no one's been fired yet. No one probably will get fired yet. One of the joys of running email lists, and I've been running one for supporting the DOD and the intelligence community for the past 8 years now, pretty high volume, is that everybody posts under their name or a known name. Meaning that if I get an email sent to this list from William Knowles, I know William Knowles. I've got a level of knowledge and competence that I can authenticate him and at least substantiate the information he's providing. So if there's a complaint from somebody else that, what's he saying, I can say, "No, I know him, he's got good sources, so be it." But if it's, you know, joker22@hotmail.com, well, that could be anybody. It could be William Knowles, it could be my alter ego when I'm drunk, it could be anybody. How do you verify that? How do you hold that person accountable for that information? We don't know. I love these mailing lists where you see people, and hacker handles I've finally come to accept. So I've got several friends who do have hacker handles, and I call them that instead of their real name. Problem. I can always count on him to be a source of amusement in my speeches, always. Whether it's New York, Cleveland, or Detroit, you're like my number one groupie. you get a cookie. Okay. So other issues we have is that we need to have a way where if we're sharing all this information, that no single user can compromise the system in general, cannot compromise security. I think back to information sharing in the old intelligence community. Some of these names may sound familiar. Aldrich Ames, Nicholson, Robert Aldrich, others. Go back in time, 20, 30 years. One person was able to compromise huge amounts of intelligence and information and hack the system, if you will, from the inside. They were a friendly adversary. They were in under the radar. How could they do this? Because once they were in, who here saw The Recruit, the movie? Al Pacino, what's her name, Bridget Moynihan, I think, whatever. There's a great line in there, and it's kind of true, even though it was done in Hollywood style. Al Pacino's talking to, who's the guy, the lead guy? Colin Farrell. And he says, when you get into CIA headquarters, once you're in the gate, you're in. It's one giant village. You can go anywhere. Their whole idea is to keep people out. For better or worse, there's some logic in that. And that's not really how it works, but the idea is that once you're in, as we all know, you're the insider. You can do some really nice damage if you wanted to. So there's a concern about how do we prevent that, or at the very least minimize or mitigate the damage. All too often, the response to this challenge is to just flat out close the door. And in that case, you're not mitigating the damage, you're trying to eliminate it flat out. And there may be a lot of good that you're cutting off because you're slamming the door as opposed to looking for other solutions. The bottom line is these challenges and others that are not listed here, chances are handled one of two ways. Either through the application of technology, be it encryption, trusted networks, VPNs, passwords, or heavy-handed policies, laws, and regulations that make it very cumbersome to use that information or exchange it when you need it. One of the hardest problems in the intelligence community is having information and getting it to the right people at the right time so they can use it when they need it. I've got a good friend of mine who's serving in Iraq right now. He's a Marine gunnery sergeant. And he says he'd rather have something that's 80% reliable that he can use right now and give it to you and you and you and go out and do a mission than get something that's 100% reliable, requires a safe and 3 armed guards because it's so classified. That extra security hinders his ability to do his job. Take that analogy and put it in the context of emergency services, post 9/11. If I can get information that's pretty darn reliable and corroborated from a couple of different sources, get it out in the field fast to police, fire, whoever, and they can save lives as a result, isn't that better than the opposite, which would be adding layers of cumbersome security, other controls? That means that it might take 3 hours as opposed to 3 seconds for something that will occur and be exchanged, whether it's voice, video, or data. I'd say err on the side of helping somebody. One good example of where we're headed. They said there are the 3 schools of vulnerability disclosure: full disclosure, zero disclosure, and responsible. This is the trend that we're seeing about moving towards a policy of zero disclosure. I'll just give you a second to kind of skim through it. This is taken from the Homeland Security Act of 2002, when the DHS was stood up. A little section buried deep in the legislation. Some of this is a little interesting from not just a security perspective, but just a citizen's concerned about his government perspective. What they're really saying here is, in the first case, is that the government, in this case Homeland Security, wants to receive information from, let's say, backbone providers, software vendors, chemical plant companies. Give us this information so we can better assess your level of risk to a terrorist attack or an emergency. We, as the government, cannot publish that information without your permission. On one hand, this makes sense. If you're going to air your dirty laundry out, you don't want it being aired out to the world. But what if the government finds information there that presents a public health hazard or a danger to public safety or public cyber safety? Should they be able to release it to the world? Ideally, I would say yes. The law says they can't. They have to tailor it and wash it down and water it down first. Once the information is in government hands, and this is the best one, the second bullet, if a chemical plant has an accident and people suspect that it could have been prevented by better security or better safety or inspections, and somebody sues the chemical company or the government, why didn't you do something? The information that chemical company gave the government cannot be used in court. This is a broad indemnification under the guise of keeping critical information away from terrorists. Think back to Enron and WorldCom. What we're seeing here is terrorism and security, public safety, being used as a way to also kind of shoehorn in some good things for the corporations to escape accountability from their shareholders and the public. Yes, sir?
Do you see these provisions more in the context of the government releasing information about the companies, or more in the public requesting information from the government about the companies?
The latter. The government traditionally does not, and that goes back to the issue of cybersecurity and computer crime investigations in the 80s and 90s. People wouldn't go to the FBI because they were afraid that their vulnerabilities would come out in the court. So the government doesn't really do that. But this is if I sue my local power plant and it goes to court, and there's hints that there are damaging evidence or damaging reports that the government has on them, I can't get those reports to help my case out.
Yeah, but you can still use traditional disclosure.
No.
Go after the power company.
No, because the power company, which I didn't include on here actually, would under the new revised laws, says that if they deem it to be critical, I forget what the designation, critical infrastructure information, they are exempt from giving it to anybody under any circumstances.
But nobody would ever abuse it, would they?
Not at all. Not at all. Now, let's keep in mind, and the others are self-explanatory, the federal law overrides any state or local Freedom of Information Acts. So this standardizes this disclosure position. What is interesting is, I think it was on Slashdot last week or 2 weeks ago, it was a rehash of a story that I've heard repeatedly since 9/11. The use of... the government has said to private pilots, you cannot fly around nuclear power plants, chemical plants, whatever. Makes sense. I kind of agree with that. Having been a pilot, I steered clear of those things. But they say you cannot fly near these, but we can't tell you where these areas are. The blind leading the blind. I don't even know where to begin. But this is the logic that we're seeing, where we consider something so sensitive. Now, who here lives near a nuclear power plant? Which one, sir? Which one?
Bessie.
Bessie? Okay. If you wanted to find Bessie Power Plant, how would you go look for it? You're a terrorist.
Just go to
the horizon.
But terrorists don't have eyes. They wouldn't look around for things, would they?
Anyway, you wouldn't need a terrorist. First energy, you'd probably blow it up first.
Okay, but terrorists won't go like driving around looking for a power plant or plumes, would they? That's just that's so low tech. Would a terrorist go to a 7-Eleven and purchase a map?
Yeah.
A road map? And maybe they would go driving around and see, okay, there's a power plant there, but I don't see it on the map. I guess it doesn't exist. I don't think so. You see where this is going. Phone books, the list goes on. This sort of convoluted logic presents the illusion that we are controlling information and therefore strengthening our security, when we're not. We're doing the exact opposite and having a damn good laugh at the same time. There are other examples of that. Last year, there was a Homeland Security regulation or request for comment that came out. And it simply, and I'll read it for you because it's kind of small print. This is talking about cellular phone network outages. While this information is critical to identify and mitigate vulnerabilities in the system, it can equally be employed by hostile actors to identify vulnerabilities for the purpose of exploiting them. Depending on the disruption in question, the errant disclosure to an adversary of this information concerning even a single event may present a grave risk to the infrastructure. This was in response to, I think it was Singular. There was a major Singular outage in Texas. It was last year, last fall, I think. And people wanted to know why their cell phones weren't working. Singular posted, there are outages in these areas. Government said, oh my God, that could be used by a terrorist. thinking that, okay, if they know the cell phones aren't working, we're more vulnerable because we can't coordinate. Now, let me put this in perspective. Y'all are from the Midwest for the most part, right? Anybody here from Florida? Cool. What part? South Florida? Naples. Close enough. I'm from South Florida, Fort Lauderdale, Hollywood, Miami. Grew up with hurricanes. Those of you around here, blizzards? Tornadoes?
Used to have blizzards.
Severe weather of one sort. Have you been without power?
Oh, yes.
Have you been without running water for a day or whatever? Have you been without traffic lights?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Have you stocked up on bread and water for a couple of days because you weren't sure if you could get to the store because the roads were not plowed? Probably. But we're all still here. We're all alive, I think. Where's Jody? I'll pay for that, I know. I'll buy her a drink now. Paul, too, it's all right. But we're all alive as a result. The same thing could happen with a civil disturbance or a terrorist attack of some sort. People say, well, someone could hack the power grids. We without streetlights or running water, or our sewers would back up. That's happened already. It doesn't scare me. Shouldn't scare you. But again, the possibility that these things could happen, keyword could, has resulted in a mindset that's now reminiscent back of the Cold War mindset, where it was us versus the evil, bad, red communists, and we must therefore censor it out of the public eye because it could be used against us. I highlighted the products and services because that's my little crusade concern at the moment, which is, as I alluded to before, when you've got companies and vendors hiding behind Homeland Security rules to cover up their own mistakes and escape accountability. A lot of times we're seeing information, and having worked in the intelligence field, all right, I mean, I've been on the inside of the green door, to use the spooky term. Most of what I've seen, albeit in the IT security space, that's been classified, all this, you know, mumbo jumbo, has been the same stuff that I will see when I go home and it's in my inbox, seen at a conference, talked about with over friends over beer and drinks, same information. There's no special IP addresses or whatever. Threats are the same. The vulnerabilities are the same. But the classification was being done to allow either the agency in question or the office or the organization or people to avoid accountability or to say, I know a secret and Drew doesn't. So you better play nice with me come next budget cycle or you're not going to get your money. That's the way Washington works. And if you talk to people like Bruce Schneier, Dorothy Denning, me, we will all tell you the same thing, that a lot of what we're seeing in security these days, whether it's vulnerability disclosure or the broader sense of homeland security or cybersecurity, is smoke and mirrors. Schneier has a great analogy. He calls it security theater. I like that. I really do. It's the illusion of security. We have, who flew in to the conference? TSA, the baggage, the passenger screeners, you know, the gate rapers. Take off your shoes. Show me your laptop. Show me your panties. Oh, is this a sex toy? Put it away. You know, whatever. Those folks are there to make the flying public feel safe. They are ineffective. Government auditors have said so. It's illusion. And when they do screw up and the reports come out, they're so heavily redacted because they don't want to let the information help a bad guy. Meanwhile, we as the traveling public can't hold them accountable because we don't know the full picture. So the laundry list down here just are some of the ways that secrecy can be used to politicize things, it's really a question of power. Budgetary power, power to avoid accountability, political power, those are some fun ones. So how do we fix this? This is a huge problem, and Richard kind of talked about some of these last night. The first is, we need to build trust. Trust does not come from VeriSign. Trust does not come from Microsoft or any vendor, any company, any techno-babbly process. Trust comes from people. That's us. Now let's take an example of security in action. We talk about community security exchange. I was just talking about you two. Oh, God. I'm in trouble. Let's talk about security vulnerabilities in general. That's probably the best way to start. Or take a Homeland Security case, whichever. There are really five levels of trust involved. You got the message itself. There's a problem in FARC 3.51. Okay, that's the message. Drew announces it. That sounds pretty important. I mean, hell, it's his software. I mean, you know, it's his company. Okay. He's a cool guy. He's pretty down to earth. I mean, he's been right before. He's been wrong a few times too. But you know, he's made good on when he's made good to us when he's screwed up. Okay, I trust him to be pretty honest with me. But as you go out and farther away from the individual, the level of trust gets less and less. Go to the institutional level, and we're talking now in cybersecurity when the FBI gets involved, or DHS, or other government folks getting involved. When I was at Network Solutions, there were many times that I could not stand working with certain federal law enforcement folks because the people themselves were very nice and very cool. And they apologized that they couldn't do more, but their hands were bound. Why were their hands bound? Because their institutional performance, the next ring up, tied their hands from being truly effective cybercrime people. So as the victim or a partner in this response, I was a little leery of working with them or giving them so much information to help solve the case. I was a victim, but I wasn't, I mean, in some ways, you know, the good guys scared me more than the bad guys did. Especially the FBI. Some of those folks just do not have a clue. And then finally, the upper level is the socio-political climate. And this high level is what we've seen pretty much since 9/11, with the anything that could be used by a bad guy should be kept out of public view. These five layers, when you look at them, they all come back to one thing. And actually, there is a piece of technology that is responsible for all this. It's wetware. Wetware starts with the message. Who crafts the message? Wetware is a who, by the way. Wetware. Complicated computer, easiest one to mess with. And it goes up from there. Wetware is responsible for delivering the message, how we perceive the message, how we act on the message, how we believe the bigger picture around us is, how the world. Theme talked about perception management. This is part of it. Trust is based on perception management. Who here has or been social engineered? Everybody should be raising your hands. I'm doing it right now. This is all bogus now. No. And if you had a boyfriend or girlfriend, you know you're being socially engineered. Okay. Social engineering preys on the victims to do what? Get a nugget of trust in the person's mind and exploit that nugget for whatever purposes. But trust is where we need to start if we're going to find any way to resolve this information sharing conundrum between the guys who want to share it all and the guys who don't want to share anything. The community's huge. I will make no bones about it. Can you see this in the back of the room? The ladder? Okay. Take a minute and think about this ladder in terms of cybersecurity and then politics. Even cars, public safety, consumer products. At the low end, you've got no participation from the consumer, from the end users, from the community. We are just resources. On the high end, you've got a degree of citizen power where we are running the show. We are informed. We are a part of the decision-making process. We are an equal player with the vendors, the government, whoever else. And the spectrum rises and falls accordingly. Where do you think we are in terms of cybersecurity, vulnerability disclosure, and discussion on this ladder? Anybody? Informing. Okay. You are a security vendor. You are Symantec. Where do you fit on this ladder? Zero? somebody else besides zero? Five, you said? 0.5. Okay, between 1 and 8. If you're a vendor, chances are you're looking at the partnership thing because your business model relies on cybersecurity vulnerabilities existing. Right? If you're a Symantec, what's the one thing you don't want to see happen? Windows to go away. Right? You don't. You, NIMDA CirCam, whatever the next bug du jour is, that is like catnip to you. Because you know your job is going to be safe for a good long time. With that mindset, their goals and their motivations on information sharing are skewed. Because they're not so per se interested in looking at helping you. They're interested in helping themselves. That's why you see issue as opposed to major problem. Feature opposed to unnecessary. Things like that. Where you stand goes a long way in how you're being perceived by the community, and in reverse, how we and what our ability to act and help ourselves are in such cases. We'll talk about that. Security is different in a couple of key ways, and this is my bread and butter is IT security. Information security and the spread of vulnerability information, exploits, whatever, helps us because we can see what bad coding looks like, see how mistakes are made, learn from that, and apply that to the future. At least that's the ideal case. Now, I said exploits. I don't mean we should be publishing exploits. I think that's kind of pushing the envelope in some cases. But saying there's a problem, here's what the problem is, here's what it looks like, that's very helpful. Information security, cybersecurity is not the equivalent of Ebola or smallpox. People in this room, we can be dangerous with computers, no doubt about it. People in this room, for the most part, can't be dangerous with smallpox. We don't have the technology, the mindset, the know-how. So the potential for us to launch a smallpox attack is limited. The potential for us to spread malicious code, it's pretty up there, or it could be. So in this case, secrecy really doesn't benefit anybody because you're rolling the dice. I love going to government conferences when they say we should classify everything. And they do. They try to say that. Because they forget one little important thing. Say that just because the U.S. government classifies something, we know a secret, we're going to keep it to ourselves, doesn't mean that the Russians, the Chinese, us, that we don't already know about it. 0 days can be out months before the government hears about it. And that does kind of happen. So by classifying all this information, who's it really helping? Nobody. An ongoing problem with this within the security space is that there's really no major difference between what's an attack tool, a hacker tool, and a legitimate tool of defense or system administration tool. A couple years ago, CDC released Back Orifice, and then BO2K. Which one? Yeah. Came out, and what did it say? This is an evil hacker tool. It's bad. It's malicious. It's bad code. What? Why? Because it lets somebody remotely control a system.
Eject CD-ROM.
Exactly. But yet, you could go drop $1,000 to CompUseless and get what?
PC Anywhere.
PC Anywhere, Timbuktu, any number of things. You can pull down something like, you know,
VNC.
I was saying VLC. VNC. And do the exact same thing.
But PC Anywhere doesn't wrap itself around other executions.
True. However, work with them. But the reality... But
you eject the CD-ROM.
It also...
Right. There are subtle differences. Those are features. That's why I like that tool. But the functionality is the same. And yes, there are some differences, and you know they're valid points.
Does PC Anywhere go on IRC?
It could. Well, if you use Visual Basic Scripting and you scripted a couple of little applets, you could drop it in there and probably could work something out.
Or like a checkbox.
Exactly. But regardless, the functionality was pretty much the same for the most part. There are some features, of course. So in my mind, there's no difference. When I had a government person come into my office when I was working for a government security group, and they said, well, why do you have these hacker tools? I'm like, these are what we use to test our security. Well, we have a security budget. Yeah, we bought ISS sitting in the shrink wrap. You know, these are better. So there's no difference. It doesn't really benefit anybody to draw that line anywhere. Looking at publishing security knowledge presents this ignorance that we're seeing in the security space. We talk about, you know, Richard talked last night about, you know, you could be so caught up in the environment that you're unable to see outside of the environment. That's true. That's why you'll never see security consultants, security companies, vendors say what really will implement strong security. I'm not saying just get off Microsoft, but offer sound practices, saying Sarbanes-Oxley or HIPAA sounds good, doesn't work. There's too much money in there. It's job security for them. But yet, checking boxes does not strengthen our security. Long story short, when we're trying to classify things and keep things to ourselves, the odds are against us because we may know it, but chances are somebody somewhere in the world knows it as well. I was in Brazil a couple of years ago giving a lecture to a very scary audience, which is the Brazilian Central Intelligence Agency. Yeah. This is a U.S.-sponsored trip, I will say, so it's okay. I was terrified. 250 people in an audience, they had not a smile on them at all. One light coming down on stage, I'm sitting at a desk, a table with a microphone and a pitcher of water on it. Like I was in, like, you know, Lubyanka, and like, you know, who's going to shoot me? Question came up during Q&A. Of course, there were like three or four embassy folks there who were with me and somebody from our CIA who was there to kind of see what questions were being asked of me, the cybersecurity guy coming here to lecture. Question came up. What's your take on the restriction of encryption, strong encryption by the U.S. government? How come you can have it and other countries can't? I'm like, oh, I didn't want to deal with politics here. I want to go back to my country. You know, I've got to wash the car. Please don't do this. And I stopped for a minute and I said, look, when you think about it, encryption is simply mathematics. This is a brilliant response. I mean, I'm very proud of myself for how I phrased this. In this environment, there's a bead of sweat running down my back at this point. I said, crypto is simple as mathematics. And whether you find out now or in 15 years, you're going to find out. So I don't agree with the policy, but just think of it as math and you'll do okay. And the CIA guy is like, good one. It's like, whew, no diplomatic incident here. But it comes back to saying the odds are against us because we may know about it, but it'll come out eventually. We were talking about trusting each other, and there's a lot of text here, but really what it comes down to is that we're trusting more and more things. We're people. We're human. We trust each other. We build trust. We gain trust. Hopefully we keep trust. The same is true with computers and systems and networks. But over time, as we start accepting and embracing more and more people in our network of trust, this system that has all this trust involved can be completely subverted from the inside if one person, one friendly adversary, messes up. As I said earlier, the Hansen case, Ames, you name it. There's a great paper that came out. I've got it upstairs called The Collision of Paradigms. And it goes into how you define trust for the new millennium. It's really good. I'll give a URL if you guys want. We're almost done. We'll really quickly go through a couple of myths and realities. And this is applicable whether we're talking about cybersecurity or public safety or anything in between. Telling people about a risk is more likely to cause alarm than if we say nothing. Reality is, it means we give people a chance to express their concerns and take action. If I'm a systems administrator and there's a zero day out there, I want to know what to look for. Tell me, here's a snippet of code, here's what it looks like, I'll throw it up in my snort filter, I'll look, at least I can be on guard for something. That's letting me do something to empower myself and take charge, rather than sitting back waiting for a vendor alert that might never come. Number two, communication is less important than education. If people knew the true risks, they would accept them. The reality is, and this is what I've been talking about, we have to pay just as much attention to the process we use to communicate these risks. Risk communication, trust, interpersonal skills. Pay as much attention to those skills as we do to the actual message itself. I love the third one. We shouldn't go public until we have a solution. Sound familiar? That's where we are right now. And as I said, I want to know something, give me some little bit of information, A, to help me protect myself, and B, allow me to feel that I'm part of the security community at large, that I can make a difference, that I'm not just an end user slave. So these issues are too public and too complicated for the end users to understand. Well, the reality is, the end users don't need to know every technical nitty-gritty detail. You can release multiple vulnerability alerts. Some places do, the government does. But we have to remember to separate public disagreement with our policies with the actual message itself and remediating the vulnerability in question. Those of us who are geeks may have a problem with this next one. Leave technical decisions in the hands of the technical people. Again, not to bastardize or rip themes talk, but he said last night, people in security these days need to be both engineers and executives and know the business processes. This talks to it. We need to provide the public with the information about the vulnerabilities. We need to understand their concerns. And if I'm reporting a vulnerability, I need to know the vendor's ability to respond and deal with what I've reported to them. There was a case a few years ago where a bug was found in the AOL Instant Messenger client. The Matt released the vulnerability, I think it was like 2 days before Christmas, publicly. AOL went ballistic. Well, our staff's on vacation. I mean, give us 48 hours. We couldn't respond. I can go either way. On one hand, yeah, well, it's holiday, but still, you're a big ISP. You should have a 24-hour security team. The flip side, Matt was immature by only giving AOL 2 days to respond, knowing it was a holiday weekend, and it looked to everybody like he was doing it for kicks. And he got slammed for it in the security community. Risk communication is not my job. Whether you're a public servant, whether you're a security person, whether you're a vendor, you've got a responsibility. We all do. We need to make sure we know how to communicate effectively and not give the wrong messages. If we give them, whoever them is, an inch, they'll take a mile. Well, in reality, if we give them a little bit, or if we give them a fair amount up front, they'll be happy and go away. But if we give them too little or say, well, it's classified, they'll say, oh, yeah, why? And they won't go away. And your problems then compound. And finally, if we disclose too much, the public will be further at risk. As I said, if the public knows, anybody can know. Information itself is neutral. We can help somebody or it can hurt somebody. What matters is how it's used. So I'm going to leave you with my last two slides. How do we formulate trust? And the lesson here is, in communicating in a community environment, it comes down to people and it comes down to trust. You can't get around it. Technology will not help us. So if you want Rick's pithy witticisms for the day, here they are. During a crisis or during a security event, how you act depends on where you stand. If I'm an FBI agent, I'm going to act in accordance with the FBI's directives and the institution. Think back to that 5-point chart I showed you before. Where you stand on an issue depends where you sit. If I'm in the FBI, where I stand on it will be whatever the FBI policy is on this given issue, or item, or bug, or problem, or crisis, or whatever. How I am perceived by those involved in the crisis will depend on where I sit. So if I'm the FBI, and I'm working with Paul, for example, I'm just picking on you, don't worry, you can leave. Paul's going to know that I'm FBI. He's going to know that I'm going to react a certain way, that I will act accordingly, and may or may not be the bestest friend in the world to him during this problem. In which case, how well he, as the user, can handle the situation depends on how well we all are perceived. You know, we're talking about these circles of trust, okay? So if Paul knows I'm going to act a certain way, and Paul and Drew are partners, you know, Paul's at AOL and Drew's at Earthlink. And they're good buddies, they're drinking buddies, they email each other and they have fun, and they trust each other. That's where the action is going to start. So Dean was saying last night, talk about, you know, the communities of interest and these little cells that can do things under the radar. That is under the radar. They will resolve an issue or be well on the way to resolving an issue long before me and the FBI get involved, because we're slow to respond. We've got this huge perception gap we're trying to overcome. Ultimately, how well the situation is resolved depends on all of us being able to reconcile these factors in a way that works effectively. Which means I can't come in and say, hey, Paul, I'm from the FBI. Give me all your data and then go away. That's what I've told them before. We're number one. FBI. I've been burned by them before. And I'm not meaning to sound angsty, but in some ways I guess I probably could be, because this has happened. $2 million network security incident. They came in, they wanted all of our logs, all of our data, all of our evidence. They went away. We never heard back from them, ever. Am I going to work with them in the future? No, I didn't. So how do we gain public trust? Well, and public trust, I mean people beyond our immediate organization. We need to accept and involve others as equal partners in an incident or in the analysis of a vulnerability or a problem. We need to inform people and not replace actions with speculation or mix public concern or dissent with the message. Again, good communication skills. I love looking and lurking on mailing lists where you see the real hardcore people discussing nuances of a given exploit. And they're working down here at the micro level, and everybody else is working higher up. They get confused and caught up in the nuance of how something is worded when the reality is it's unimportant in the grand scheme of things. So again, it comes back to good communication and focusing on the message and the mission at hand, not the ego. I mentioned Rudy Giuliani. We got to be honest, be frank, and open. I would love for a software vendor to say, yep, we screwed up. There's a problem. Oh, wait, somebody did actually. Apple did that with iTunes a couple of years ago. When you installed a new version of iTunes, it wiped out your iTunes music folder. They admitted, oops, we got a problem. They pulled the software. And they offered to pay anybody for data recovery to recover their MP3s. That was the only case of a mea culpa I've seen on that level from a software vendor. Got to be honest, got to be accountable, be open. As I say, trust is very hard to obtain in such cases. And we've talked about Microsoft and AOL. Do you think I trust them right now? Why do you think that? Because I've seen them in action before. Trust, once you lose it, is very hard, if not impossible, to regain. So don't lose the trust. And finally, whether you're a vendor, you're a security guy, and you're working the case, meet the needs of the media, the people out there. Not just the media reporters and the press, but again, the people outside of your organization. And know, in communicating with people outside your organization, what their motivations are. The press are interested in the politics. They want a scandal. End users might want something different. Executives might want something yet again. When I talk and teach on incident response, I do a whole module just on interpersonal skills based on who you're talking with. Executives, how do you deal with them? Users, other techies, you know, group managers, lawyers, human resources. They all have different nuances that you need to know how to deal with. Same thing here.
Dilbert,
exactly. Finally. I wonder which message is really more important here. Security informatics, which one?
The one in bold. Which are available for sale at the front desk.
Well, you missed the other plug I did for you at the beginning.
God bless your soul.
I'm trying to make up for things, dude. I talk about security informatics, and just so you know, my PhD research is on vulnerability disclosure and this issue of security versus secrecy. Versus openness. So this is kind of a small subset of the greater picture of what I'm working on. But what I'm finding thus far is that we've got to be community-centric in our response to IT security concerns and discussing how to deal with and remediate vulnerabilities as they come up. Doing that, we've got to trust the people we're working with, be they other researchers, hackers, vendors, government folks, non-government, whoever the case is, trust is important. And we're not going to get it through secrecy. And the bottom line is that, at least this is my personal political view here, is that if we're going to create a culture of trust, we had better err on the side of helping protect people, saving lives, securing services, than preventing the data from falling into the bad guy's hands. That's where we're heading right now. Unfortunately, that terrifies me as a security person, terrifies me as a citizen. And hopefully, it's starting to terrify you as well. With that, I am 2 minutes and 15 seconds away from being thrown off the stage. Are there any questions, comments, dirty looks? Question?
Just a little question real quick. On that graph that you had, we do the 5-point graph on levels of trust. You have two axes there. One goes to the next axis, one goes to the next direction. I was just wondering if you could explain
it. Sure. I can. Next question. Basically, I mean, the axes, if you go out, take the outer band, socio-political climate, all right, that's probably the easiest one to explain because the message gets very complicated because you've got so many other players and spinmeisters involved. And as the complexity gets greater and greater, the people who are involved know less and less about the issue at hand. So the degree of the level of abstraction is greater. Because you get a politician saying, cyber terrorists are bad and must be eliminated. Nuke them all. Senator, what's a cyber terrorist? They're a bad guy. They're out here. As opposed to, a Bruce Schneier talking about the issue, who is way down the towards the axis because, you know, the guy's got a major clue. That answer your question? Yes, sir.
Last one. You mentioned about setting up the content filters and those kind of things for 0 day.
Mm-hmm.
A true 0 day, you would have no idea what to filter. You'd have to cut everything.
Your point?
Well, the point is, how do you handle that? You cut everything?
No, zero days are just that, 0 days. That's when they just come out. Chances are you're not going to know about when they're out until they start populating in the wild and being applied. So there's always going to be the knowledge gap in favor of the adversary. That's a reality that people seem to forget.
Okay, but what are you going to do? There's nothing you can filter on.
Everybody's going to talk about it. This is about talking about security.
Right. The idea, I mean, there will always be that gap, and you cannot, I mean, you can maybe shrink it somewhat if somebody finds out about the 0 day and goes public with it or whatever, but there will always be that window of vulnerability where you will not be able to do anything because you don't know about it. Well, if it's made public, it's not a 0 day anymore. Then it's a today. I mean, at that point, then it's a vulnerability. It's probably got a CVE. It's, we know about it, and we're going to start moving forward. I mean, I don't know the exact definition of a 0 day, but once it becomes out in the public, it's no longer a 0 day. Am I correct? For the most part, yes, no? Where are my security geeks?
My definition is once you can do something about it. Otherwise, it's...
Right. Well, once you do something about it...
...happy with semantic, then, yeah, it's no longer a 0 day.
Once you can do something about it...
It's still not a 0 day. It's a 0.1.
We can talk about this offline if you want, because they're going to kick me off the stage. Is there any other questions or comments? I will be hanging around here. I will be holding court at the bar from around 8 o'clock tonight until closing time. So feel free. Thanks a lot for listening, not throwing things, for staying awake. Thank you.